I'll tell you something funny about this collection. The first title was Too Jewish.
Oh my goodness, really?
Don't you think the stories are really too Jewish?
Shalom and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, our guest is Professor Derek Pensler, author of Zionism, An Emotional State, and chair of the Harvard University Presidential Task Force on Combating Anti-Semitism and Anti-Israel Bias. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. I've been thinking about what it is that creates a true community of people that goes beyond, our nuclear families. In one sense, community is about shared experience. We go to temple together with folks. Our kids attend the same schools. We see each other at drop-off and pick-up. We volunteer at the same food kitchen or Habitat House regularly. Or maybe we sing in the same choir or in a writing group together, work with them preparing food for Kiddush or Onig Shabbat. Maybe we live on the same block, play on their softball team, go to the same exercise class or bicycle or run with them or swim with them. Could be in Rotary Club or Chamber of Commerce together, invite the same groups of people for holiday dinners every year. Perhaps we work on a community issue together, on a committee or a board or a campaign. Or maybe it's just that we see the same folks all the time at communal events. These are the soft ways community is formed, in which we get to know others and see who we like and enjoy, or maybe just who we wish to hang out with, or whom we end up grouped with the most, watching our kids play Little League. Now, sometimes these connections of community are based on shared belief and ideology, or shared religion. Sometimes not. But even among similarly minded people, say other Jews, if you're Jewish, or hiking enthusiasts, or dancers, or Wildcat basketball fans, or whatever the connection is, just how those ties of community are built can be a little bit mystical. Is it shared experiences, respect, responsibility, liking the same stuff, disliking the same stuff, doing things the same way? What is it that ties us to other human beings we aren't related to? What binds us into genuine community? And what does that word community really mean? The Hebrew word is kehilah, which is pretty much an assembly of folks. Hakel et ha'am, the Torah instructs Moses, gather the people together. The larger term for a synagogue is kehilah kedosha, a sacred community or community of holiness. Does that mean that the whole group of people who happen to belong to a congregation at any one moment are a real community? I mean, congregations are ever-changing things. People join a congregation, new people are born, people die, people move away, people switch congregations, and so on. Does the current membership of a synagogue or a church or a mosque really form true community? And how are we to think of today's virtual communities, the online hundreds of friends people have on Facebook, the Instagram broadcasters, the millions of people who follow influencers on TikTok and YouTube, the Reddit subthreads, and, so on? If everyone is watching the same thing passively, does that create community? I've been exploring this question as I navigate the preparations involved in the Jewish High Holy Days. Coming up fast, Rosh Hashanah is October 2nd, just 2.5 weeks from now. To be honest, this is not a new challenge for me as a congregational rabbi. After all, if you are growing a synagogue, something I've now done at 3 different congregations over my career, you seek always to build community. best, it should be a community dedicated to the same vision, the temple, synagogue, or congregation, where people care about and respect one another, that seeks to offer the finest religious services, Jewish education for children and adults, social action work, Jewish music, cultural and intellectual experiences, and relationship building that it can. But how does that compare with what really happens? The High Holy Days are an interesting time to explore this. In some ways, they're a wonderful period in which we see our Jewish communities active and involved. In another sense, they are an absolute exception to what our communities truly are. I remember doing a sermon on Rosh Hashanah way back at the beginning of the reality TV craze, about 20 years ago, in which I compared the Jewish days of awe, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, to a reality TV show. The Yamim Noraim, the High Holy Days, are like the show Survivor or The Apprentice. Here were a few days a year when the whole congregation suddenly appeared, dressed up all fancy, in order to pray, sing, read together aloud in English, and chat with people they haven't seen in 12 months, ever since the end of last year's Yom Kippur. On the Day of Atonement, a lot of them even fasted without food and water for the whole day. And all of us acted like this was the norm for our synagogue community, this High Holy Days island in which we had to survive until Ne'ilah, the closing blast of the shofar that ended Yom Kippur, and when, released from the reality experience, we could go back to our normal lives and do none of the things we had just spent those special days doing together. That is, after surviving long services and fancy clothes and elaborate music and long sermons and pleas for charitable action and tzedakah for the congregation in Israel, everybody got to leave the island. But while we were at temple on the days of awe, we all acted as though we were present like this all the time and would be there for the whole year just like that, like this was real, not reality. Now, we know reality TV is anything but real. Imagine pretending you're living a normal life while film crews shoot your every conversation and an editor assembles it all into something quite different than what just happened. Not real. Not reality TV at all. Just as we know that TikToks and Instagram posts and Facebook minis and YouTube shorts are all essentially fabricated ways to make it seem like community exists between people who have no real relationships. But you know what can be real? An actual congregational community in which we support each other, care about each other, pray and work together. A synagogue community in which we come together not just once or twice a year on the High Holy Days. I mean, yes, we should do that, of course, but in which we work together all year to make a difference in our lives and in the world. A community in which we study and learn together, celebrate together, grieve together, cook and eat together, help each other and those in our larger world who need help. An actual, intentional experience of sharing joy and sorrow, of seeking meaning and understanding, of repairing the damage we see in the world around us. That's what community is and can be. That's what Jewish community should be, based around the synagogue congregation. To play us in this morning on Too Jewish, then, on the theme of community as we approach the High Holy Days, here's Dan Nichols singing his setting, Kehila Kedosha, Sacred Community.
If you are a 10, then we're Nitzavim. We stand here today, remember the dream. If you are a 10, then we're Nitzavim. We stand here today, remember the dream. If you are a 10, then we're Nitzavim. We stand here today, remember the dream. If you are a 10, then we're Nitzavim. We stand here today. Kedosha. Right.
That was Dan Nichols, Kehila Kedosha, a holy community. You know, you can be part of a holy community like that right now. Just arrange to attend Congregation Beit Simcha's beautiful Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur services. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. It's just 2.5 weeks now until Rosh Hashanah. BeitSimchaTucson.org has beautiful musical services. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Professor Derek Penslar of Harvard University, head of their Jewish Studies Department, author of the book Zionism, an Emotional State, and chair of the Harvard University Presidential Task Force Combating Anti-Semitism and Anti-Israel Bias. We have a lot to ask Professor Penslar when we come back in just a moment right here on Too Jewish.
A great new class for everyone. This Is Judaism offers everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism but didn't get to ask. Who was Abraham? What is the Torah? How long have Jews been around? In three fun, informative sessions, This Is Judaism brings the joy of Jewish life and learning to you. Rabbi Sam Kohan teaches what Jewish values, spirituality, and community are all about. All classes are open to everyone, Jewish or not. Best of all, This Is Judaism is completely free, but you must pre-register. Want your kids to understand Jewish heritage, history, and holidays? Want to try tasty Jewish food? Then This Is Judaism is for you. The classes are free, but you must pre-register. Call 520-276-5675. Visit BeitSimchaTucson.org or email rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org. This Is Judaism is taught on three consecutive Sundays or three consecutive Wednesdays this fall live with a Zoom option. There's no obligation and it's completely free. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675.
We are delighted to welcome to Jewish our guest this morning. Derek Penslar is the William Lee Frost Professor of Jewish History at Harvard University, directs the Harvard Center for Jewish Studies. He is the author of a number of excellent books on Zionism primarily and on Jewish history more generally. His book, Zionism, an Emotional State, came out last year. It's really quite fascinating. And he is the head of an important task force at Harvard addressing anti-Semitism. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
So Zionism has become a fraught word all of a sudden. Maybe it wasn't only all of a sudden. Tell us a little bit about the term itself.
Well, the word Zionism actually was invented after Zionism began, because the notion that Jews comprise a nation in the modern sense of the word, and that they have a collective identity, and that they should construct a Jewish homeland in Eretz Israel, that goes back to the 1880s, if not earlier. But the word Zionism wasn't really invented until the 1890s, and that it picked up popularity. It was employed then by Theodor Herzl in the 1890s when he constructed the Zionist organization. And really, the word Zionism retained a very, I'd say, positive meaning in much of the world through the time of the creation of the state in 1948. But the word Zionism has always had some negative connotation, to be sure, among its opponents in the Arab world, the Muslim world, and even within the Jewish world, where there were people very much opposed to Zionism, really until well after the state was established. The negative connotation of the word Zionism, that that's the case now, this is something that really has skyrocketed in recent years.
So let's define it, right? It's an important word. Zionism is what?
Well, Zionism can mean lots of things. I would define it as an idea or a set of feelings that Jews have a need and a right to a modern homeland in the ancient land of Israel. That definition can incorporate a lot of things. It leaves questions about the borders, for example, up in the air. Is it going to be the borders of King David's, you know, Eretz, kingdom of Israel?
Eretz Yisrael, right, or is it or Solomon's kingdom, which was larger, or is it the Maccabean kingdom,
or something else altogether? And there were early Zionists, really until the 1940s, Zionists rarely declared a desire for a sovereign state. One of the strange ironies that Theodor Herzl, who's famous for writing a pamphlet called The Jewish state
right.
was actually...
The Judenstaat, right.
Yeah, Judenstaat was totally open to the Jews having a province in the Ottoman Empire or being a protectorate of some European power. So Zionism has meant lots of different things, but in general, it's the notion of that idea of a modern homeland within the ancient land of Israel.
Now, you would think that would no longer be controversial, and obviously it has, you know, the idea Jews should have a homeland, people should have a homeland, and that's been where Jews have been for thousands of years. Of course, that's not true now, that it's not controversial, and it has become a flashpoint. But if someone's an anti-Zionist, they basically mean Jews shouldn't have a homeland in Israel.
Well, again, it really, you have to find out what people mean. Just like if someone says they're Zionist, it could mean lots of different things. So there are people who say they're anti-Zionist, who think that Jews have every right to live in the land of Israel, but they shouldn't live in a state that expels or occupies or oppresses Palestinians. There are other people who are anti-Zionist who say that there shouldn't be any kind of Jewish entity in what they would call historic Palestine. So the word can mean lots of different things. You know, it's funny, just as you were calling me just now, I was looking at a pamphlet written in the 1930s. That's almost 100 years ago,
right.
by leaders of the Arab Higher Committee, which was the Palestinian national leadership within mandate Palestine. And they, for them, Zionism is nothing but negativity. They see it as a colonial movement that's trying to take over their country and take away their land and deny them their own rights. So the negative connotations of Zionism go way back in time. The concept of anti-Zionism goes way back in time. All of this is old. What's happening now is simply a much greater level of volume and intensity to something that's been out there for quite a while.
We will talk much more with Professor Derek Penslar when we come back in just a moment about Zionism and Harvard a bit, too. Here on Too Jewish.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So you had an interesting experience talking to an airline person. Tell us about it.
It was very frustrating and traumatic, and I lost four nights of sleep in a row over it. But the only relevant part to this show and to our conversation is the fact that I was talking to a very bright young woman named Nora Patterson, who sounds like an American or a Brit or an Irish woman. No, she's Egyptian with an Arabic accent, working from home in Cairo, where her company, this international travel company that I always thought was based in the Bay Area, and I guess its headquarters might be in the Bay Area.
Yeah,
but
you never know where anybody is when you talk to them on the phone these days.
They have two regional offices in Cairo. And Nora explained to me that one is their like headquarters for the Middle East, and the other is their headquarters for Africa. And she said, these days, like in this decade, every multinational company, American company, she particularly had in mind, that has like one office somewhere in Africa will be in Cairo, which I found startling because the traffic there, as you know, is nightmarish.
Yeah, unbelievable.
It's scary to walk around.
Can be, yep. Although, boy, do they have a lot of police and military everywhere.
Right, but that doesn't help with the traffic.
No, it doesn't. When I was there, I remember they shut off their headlights at night to save the battery while they were driving. And I was like, oh, right. My God.
But the interesting thing is, while I was talking to this woman, she was as interested in me as I was in her. We found out a little bit about each other. She Googled me and found my podcast. Oh, Around the Jewish World with Tom Price. Is that you? I said, yeah. She said, oh, I see there's an episode on Cairo. I can't wait to listen to it. So, you know, she's like part of the globalized economy, and Cairo apparently is better integrated into that than I would have guessed. I always thought, you know, if a company had one office in Africa, it might be in an English-speaking country.
Yeah.
Like Nairobi, Nigeria or South Africa.
Right.
Perhaps. Right. Or for airline purposes, it might be in Addis Ababa because Ethiopian Airlines is the best and biggest airline in all of Africa. But apparently, I was wrong on both counts. Now, Cairo, as you know, has a long and interesting Jewish history. And that, I think, is what we want to talk about today.
Absolutely. You know, it's fascinating. People think of Egypt and they think of, you know, Passover or something. But the truth, well, okay, we were there maybe then and got out of there 3,200 and some years ago. But in fact, the Jewish community in Egypt dates back to First Temple times and certainly the destruction of the First Temple. We know that there was some kind of a Jewish temple on Elephantine Island in the middle of the Nile in which they built a temple to Yud-Heh-Vav, you know, and they were imitating the temple in Jerusalem.
And I actually knew the guy who did a lot of that archaeological research.
Oh, it's amazing.
Salel Porton.
Wow.
Have you ever heard that name?
No, I have not.
He's a professor, I think, at Penn originally. He and his family made Aliyah eventually, but they were all connected to Camp Ramon, Wisconsin, so I knew them quite well.
It's a fascinating story. I mean, this is a Jewish community that went back 2,600 years and significant, important, long before Cairo. Cairo's late antiquity, early Middle Ages kind of city.
But Cairo in the 10th century had the world's biggest university. Cairo was an intellectual and artistic center for 1,000 years.
Yeah, and a center for Jewish life, you know, the Bet Ezra Synagogue, Maimonides. I mean, there are many incredibly important Jewish figures in Cairo, but of course also Alexandria, a very cultured city. That Jewish community is significant and valuable, but really, if you go to Egypt now, you're looking at what used to be where the Jewish community was, because there's sure not much left.
Well, I think we should talk about what's left and also the story of the Cairo Geniza that not everybody knows.
Absolutely.
And a couple things about why Alexandria was such a world city and so sort of diverse and cosmopolitan. So maybe that can be our agenda for the next session.
Sounds great, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Feeling his days are numbered, Yahya Sinwar, the head of Hamas terrorists, visits a fortune teller to find out when his end will come. The fortune teller says, "You are going to die on a Jewish holiday." The terrorist demands to know which holiday, Hanukkah, Passover, Purim, which Jewish holiday will be the day of my death. And the fortune teller answers, "Any day you die will be a Jewish holiday." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, a special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. How do we go about changing our world? And how long should it take? This week's Torah portion, Ki Tavo, gives us powerful commandments about how we are to live in society. We're commanded to be moral, to protect the rights of the impoverished, widow, and the stranger. We are to be honest in business, careful of the needs of the hungry and homeless. We are to create a society of ethical practice and moral concern. We are supposed to understand that a nation is judged by how it treats its weakest, neediest members. We are told repeatedly here that God knows and expects us to live in this covenant, to uphold it, to cherish it, to make it our own. And we're told of the blessings that will be ours if we do this, and the curses we bring on ourselves if we cannot. This covenant was challenging, and large. It put real responsibilities on its members, its B'nai B'rit, to do things that aren't easy or obvious, even if they are right. No doubt our ancient Israelite ancestors sometimes struggled when told to open your hands to the poor and the needy, to welcome the stranger, to love your neighbor as you love yourself. Probably they didn't always manage to give their full tithes, to make the pilgrimage to the temple, or declare gratitude for what they had. I'll bet there were times they didn't provide adequately for the widow or the orphan. But that challenge, the daily requirement to try to live to a standard, nonetheless made them better people and made Jewish society egalitarian and generally ethical. And when they failed, they learned that what God wanted was tshuva, a return to the right course, not punishment. Positive societal change was not instantaneous, but evolutionary. But it happened for our ancestors, was codified as a practical framework by the rabbis of the Talmud afterwards. These standards should have at least as much meaning for us today. We, too, have a responsibility, as American Jews and as decent human beings, to work to make our own nation as ethical as possible. When something isn't right, we need to speak up and seek change. It is what the Torah teaches in Ki Tavo. It is what God requires of us. When we come back in a moment on To Jewish, our guest, Professor Derek Penslar of Harvard University, will give us an extraordinary definition of Zionism and explore what's going on now to address anti-Semitism and hostility to Israel at the Ivy League heavyweight institution of Harvard right now. Hear all about it when we come back in a moment on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Last week, the Israel Defense Forces General Staff Reconnaissance Unit destroyed an underground Syrian factory that was building precision missiles. That factory had been built, of course, by Iran. This was the boldest operation the IDF has carried out in recent years against Iranian targets in Syria. The destruction of the underground factory was reportedly a significant blow to Iran and Hezbollah's covert effort to produce medium-range precision missiles in Syria targeting Israel. The Israeli government, so far, has maintained silence on the matter. It is not taking responsibility. That will hopefully avoid provoking Syria, Iran, or Hezbollah into retaliating. The IDF spokesperson, the defense ministry, and the prime minister's office have all declined to comment. But it's an indication the larger strategic war against Iran and its terrorist proxies all around Israel continues to be waged by the IDF at all times and in all locations. The pain of war affects Jews in places beyond Israel. A prominent Ukrainian rabbi announced that his adopted son is dead, fighting in battle against Russian forces. Anton Matisyahu Samborsky was buried in Kiev's Jewish cemetery last week. Rabbi Moshe Osman and his wife adopted Samborsky at age 11 after the boy was orphaned. Osman is rabbi of Kiev's Brodsky Synagogue, one of various guys claiming to be the chief rabbi of Ukraine. Since Russia invaded Ukraine in February of 2022, Osman has been a vigorous advocate for the Ukrainian cause, castigating the Russians on social media, posting about efforts to distribute humanitarian aid and military supplies. Earlier, he had created a rural village to accommodate Jewish refugees during a previous Russian invasion. He called it Anatevka, after the fictional shtetl in Fiddler on the Roof. Samborsky himself had lived with his family for a decade before he moved out, married, and had a child. Shortly after Samborsky's daughter was born last May, he was drafted, Rabbi Osman, his father said, reflecting a broader mobilization of troops amid the grueling war against Putin's vicious aggression. Exactly how many Ukrainian soldiers have died in battle over the last 2.5 years is not clear. The Ukrainian government said back in February at the war's 2-year mark that about 30,000 troops had been killed. The U.S. believes the numbers are significantly higher.
Which of the Pickwick triplets did it? Who of the crew would commit this crime? Which little brat made mommy go splat? Which favorite sin will be doing hard time? Which of the Pickwick triplets did it? Which little putz had the guts to kill? Like a forensic pediatrician, I'll complete this inquisition. I will name the neonatal from the cradle that grew fatal. I will find a perpetrator who did murder to their nature.
In happier news, the EGOT is an interesting entity in the entertainment world. EGOT, E-G-O-T, is an abbreviation for an extraordinarily limited number of high achievers in the arts who have received, over the course of their careers, an Emmy, a Grammy, an Oscar, and a Tony Award. Benj Pasek became the eighth Jew to win an EGOT last week, taking the elite show business throne alongside his songwriting partner, Justin Paul. The duo won an Emmy with their original song, Which of the Pickwick Triplets Did It? I just played a little bit of that earlier. A patter song sung by Steve Martin about three infants suspected of murdering their mother from the Hulu series Only Murders in the Building. Pasek and Paul are just the 20th and 21st people to win the coveted quartet, the EGOT, Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony.
City of stars, are you shining just for me? City of stars, there's so much that I can't see. Who knows? Is this the start of something wonderful and new?
Or one more dream that I cannot make true? It's love, that's all we're looking for, is love from someone else. A ride,
a glance,
a dive,
a dance.
Look in somebody's eyes to light up the skies, to open the world and send me reeling. A voice that says I'll be here and you'll be alright.
The pair also won all the awards together, starting with a 2017 Oscar for their song City of Stars in the film La La Land, a Tony for their score of the stage musical Dear Evan Hansen later in 2017, and then a Grammy for the cast album of Dear Evan Hansen in 2018. The 39-year-old pair met as freshmen at the University of Michigan and won their first Tony nominations in 2013 for the songs in, The Christmas Story, a stage adaptation of the movie. For its TV special, they added a Jewish family and a Hanukkah song.
Have you ever felt like nobody was there? Have you ever felt forgotten in the middle of nowhere? Have you ever felt like you could disappear? Like you could fall and no one would hear? Well, let that lonely feeling wash away. Maybe there's a reason to believe you'll be okay. 'Cause when you don't feel strong enough to stand, you can reach out your hand. And oh, someone will come running, and I know they'll take you home. Even when the dark comes crashing through, when you need a friend to carry you, and when you're broken on the ground, you will be found. So let the sun come streaming in, 'cause you'll reach up and you'll rise again. Lift your head and look around, you will be found. You will be found. You
Benj Pasek joins a large proportion of Jewish artists to win the four top entertainment awards. More than a third of all EGOTs have been Jewish. First person to reach that status was composer Richard Rodgers, also Jewish, of course. Rodgers and Marvin Hamlisch, also Jewish, are the only people who added a Pulitzer Prize to their EGOT crown. Pasek was raised in a Jewish family in Philadelphia and has celebrated his ties to the Jewish community throughout his remarkable career. He's a member of the Jewish Arts and Culture nonprofit Reboot, hosted an untraditional Passover Seder for Broadway performers back in 2017. During the COVID-19 pandemic, he created Saturday Night Seder, a digital broadcast with dozens of celebrities that raised $2.5 million for the CDC Foundation. This May, Pasek spoke about his Jewish identity during a tikkun at an all-night learning event for Shavuot, the Jewish Community Center near his home on, of course, Manhattan's Upper West Side. "My Jewish identity totally informs my work," said Pasek, adding Jews have a vantage point of looking in from outside the mainstream, enabling unique insights. "It's important to be vocal about identity in politics and vocal about what you believe in, especially at a time when so many people are being marginalized as others," Benj Pasek said. "I think Jewish people particularly have a responsibility to claim their Jewishness and be champions for people in marginalized groups. It's a really important thing that you inherit that comes with being Jewish." In addition to the 21 artists who have won EGOTs in competition, six others have earned the four awards, with one achieved as an honorary or non-competitive distinction. A honorary EGOT winner includes Jewish actor and singer Barbara Streisand. And one EGOT winner who got one of them as an honorary award, who wasn't Jewish, was legendary actor James Earl Jones, who died just last week. Personal note, I had the privilege of serving as the chair of the Human Relations Council in Spartanburg, South Carolina, and brought James Earl Jones to Spartanburg to speak for Martin Luther King Jr. Day way back in, I think it was 99. It was an amazing experience, not least for his extraordinary dignity, but mostly because it brought blacks and whites and Christians and Jews together across all ideological lines to come hear James Earl Jones and celebrate Martin Luther King Jr., with whom he had marched. I remember telling the committee I would personally raise the funds to bring James Earl Jones for the event. You see, there were lots of big German companies in the Greenville-Spartanburg area, and what German company, like BMW or Hertz Celanese, could refuse to donate charitable funds when Rabbi Cohan called them to bring a black icon for Martin Luther King Jr. Day? And those German companies did not refuse. James Earl Jones was an incredibly dignified, kind, thoughtful man of immense talent and accomplishment. He signed a program when he spoke to my then 2-year-old son Boaz with a note that Mufasa had signed it. He figured that memorable role from The Lion King was more likely to be appreciated by a preschool kid than, say, Darth Vader, who he also played, of course, or Jack Johnson or Othello. Anyway, it's a great memory. May his memory continue to bring blessing. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We are delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish Professor Derek Penslar. He's professor of Jewish history at Harvard University. He's also the head of a task force there addressing anti-Semitism and the head of the Jewish Studies Center at Harvard. He's the author of, I think, a very important book, Zionism and Emotional State, as well as books about Theodor Herzl, Jews and the Military, Economic History of Jews, Jewish Settlement in Pre-State Palestine, really quite a wealth. There's no real area of Jewish history I think you haven't explored. Is that a fair statement?
I wish that were true. The Jewish civilization is ancient and it's global. And I have only scratched the surface.
You know, it reminds me of what people say about studying Talmud. Look, it's like the ocean. You don't have to drink the whole thing. You just jump in and swim for a while.
Exactly. That's what I do. I've been swimming in Jewish history and very honored to have that opportunity to study it and to teach it, especially at a place like Harvard.
Tell me a little bit about Harvard. It's been obviously very much in the news. president resigned in allegations of not having responded, among other things, to anti-Semitism appropriately. What's the environment like, and what has chairing this task force been like for you?
Well, the environment at Harvard has been, I'd say, a variation of what's been happening at universities all over North America, where for a whole variety of reasons, students and some faculty have taken on the Palestinian cause as a very important one. It symbolizes for them not only what's actually happening on the ground in Gaza, but also they combine it with a lot of domestic issues in the United States, issues involving race, involving, for example, Black Lives Matter or indigenous peoples, and a lot of different causes come together within the framework of identification with the Palestinians. And that's happening all over North America. Harvard just gets more attention because Harvard seems to always get more attention.
Is that a challenge? I mean, you know, there's an honor to that, but, you know, sometimes the honors aren't so great.
Well, you know, there's that line from Sholem Aleichem or from Fiddler on the Roof where Tevye says, God, it's great that you chose us, but I wish that maybe you'd choose
someone else, please.
Yeah, yeah. So Harvard in many ways is really quite ordinary in that we do have anti-Zionist pro-Palestinian activism. Sometimes it's quite aggressive. There have been a lot of demonstrations. There are things that are said that sometimes are very hurtful and offensive to Jewish students or to those Jewish students who identify with Israel, which is most of our Jewish students. That said, there are some Jewish students at Harvard, as at pretty much any university now, who actually identify with the Palestinian cause. So, for example, when we had our encampment last spring, where students built instead of little tents in Harvard yard for a few weeks, I'd say about 20% of the students in that encampment were, in fact, identified as Jews. So it's a complicated story where you have Jewish students who identify with Israel, which are the majority, Jews who don't, and then you have students from a whole variety of backgrounds, Muslim backgrounds, Middle Eastern, Black American students who identify with the Palestinian cause. That's been happening at Harvard. It's been happening elsewhere. At times it's turned ugly. For the most part, it's taken the form of demonstrations, of shouting. But the most worrisome thing, which has probably gotten the least press attention, is the exclusion of students from social life, shunning, the loss of friendships, this sort of thing, the kind of thing that's much harder to measure and much harder to combat, is a change in culture that's much less tolerant of difference of political viewpoint. It's happening at Harvard and everywhere else, and that's what we really have to work against.
This is really a challenge, right? I mean, one of your specialties is talking about the emotions behind movements and experiences. When emotions run high, and on young people, perhaps emotions run even higher, the responses can be really difficult to modify. What has been your task force's focus in that way?
Well, you're right. It can be absolutely devastating because there's nothing worse to any human being than to be isolated socially. That's why the cherem in traditional Judaism, excommunication, is so devastating to an individual. So what we have to do at Harvard and really any other university is rebuild a sense of community. So on the one hand, yes, we have to have stricter discipline and we have to have rules and regulations regarding protest. That's all externally imposed, and we have to work on that. But we also have to build up from the inside out. We have to start from the day our students arrive after to just fill them with the sense that they are in a community. They are very different people. They come from different parts of the world. They have very different politics. And when it comes to Israel-Palestine, they are not going to agree. But they have to understand that they must respect each other and care about each other as individuals. That's what we have to start from day one as soon as they get here.
And has Harvard not been doing that?
Well, we certainly weren't doing it enough. And there's been a real attempt this year with our orientation programs, with the various ceremonies at the beginning of the year, to fill our students with that sense of community. And for what it's worth, a student of mine who was doing freshman orientation said that the overwhelming bulk of students are here to learn from each other, to learn from their professors. They want to be part of a community. Harvard clearly has much work to do, as other universities do. We really weren't prepared for what happened last October. I mean, there had been signs of this building up for some time, but I think no university was really prepared. But now we're working hard to try to fix the problem.
I want to shift to talking about Zionism and emotional state. Your central thesis is that this nationalism is an emotional experience. Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, the book is based on an idea that most of us don't go through our lives carefully reasoning out why we do.
Really? I didn't know that. Gee.
Sometimes a scholar will state the obvious in a new way. And I'd like to think that's what I've done, is that when people talk about their attachment to a nation, whether they're American patriots or they're, I don't know, they could belong to any nationality in the world, and that includes Israeli patriotism or Zionism. It's a set of emotions. It's a set of feelings about belonging.
I'm not sure it applies to Canadians, by the way. I just want to throw that out there.
You know that I'm a dual citizen.
I do know that.
To be Canadian, all you have to do is play hockey, drink beer, and be nice.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And keep things clean. I think that's the other part. Okay, sorry. I interrupted a really important point you were making.
But essentially, human beings are emotional creatures. We live our lives fundamentally trying to avoid pain, to overcome fear, and to find love and social belonging. That's what we are. We are feeling creatures. And nationalism is a feeling of a desire for group belonging. It's filled with love. It's filled with fear and often dislike or even hatred of others. It's a very complicated feeling. It can go by other names. You know, before the 19th century, people didn't talk about themselves belonging to nations. They had other words to describe their collective belonging. But they fill us with fear, love, need, pride, and perhaps in the Jewish context, hope. I don't think it's a coincidence that the Zionist national anthem is called Hatikvah, hope, because hope is a feeling of a people that is living under oppression, in exile, in difficult conditions, that things can and will be better. It's an alternative to despair. And so I think hope is a very powerful political emotion in any national movement, and particularly in Zionism. All of these emotions have filled the Jewish world ever since the 1880s. The events of the Holocaust, of course, made those emotions infinitely more powerful. Overwhelming sense of loss and of grief and anger in which the State of Israel was born. And the State of Israel has faced many challenges, obviously, from the Arab world and challenges of founding a new state with a population from all over the world, but also dealing with that trauma, the trauma of its founding, the trauma of the Holocaust and the destruction of European Jewry. That creates a whole welter of powerful emotions that Israelis and Jews struggle with to this day.
I want to ask kind of a straight ahead historical question. And I know you're working on a book about the 1948 Arab-Israeli War and the international responses to it. Would Israel have been founded when it was, if it hadn't been for the Shoah, for the Holocaust just before?
That's a really good question. And I like thinking with counterfactuals. I'd like to say, unfortunately, you're right. Unfortunately, the Holocaust was a necessary condition, but it was not the only necessary condition. For many decades before the Holocaust, Jews had striven to build a Jewish homeland in Ottoman and Mandate Palestine. They had created a community with more than 500,000 people, and with industry and education and all the institutions of a state. There were a lot of reasons why the State of Israel was created, in addition to the aftermath of the Holocaust. But I think that the sense in the international community after the war was that Jews needed a homeland. And if I can speak quite bluntly, there were many countries that did not want to accept Jewish refugees.
Of course.
They wanted them out of Europe. The American administration didn't want them in America. And one idea was to send them to a Jewish state. So there were all kinds of positive, hopeful reasons why people wanted a Jewish state. There were perhaps less noble reasons why some people wanted a Jewish state. So, yes, I think you're right about the timing, but there was a lot more. The Holocaust is a necessary factor, but not the only factor.
Difficult question. You consider yourself a Zionist. You've been accused by Zionists of not being a Zionist. That's a strange scenario. Tell us what that feels like, speaking of emotions, and what your response would be.
I think that within any political movement, there's always going to be differences of opinion where people will gravitate to extremes and then accuse anyone who is not in their camp of being disloyal or of being a traitor. So the question is, can you believe in the fundamental right of the Jewish people, the homeland within Palestine. Can you believe in that and still acknowledge that the state of Israel today has fallen far short of what we want it to be? Is it possible to be a patriot and a critic at the same time? I can't think of a country in the world today where we would say you must not be a critic if you want to be a patriot. The United States of America is full of patriots who are very critical of their country. So I have no problem being critical and claiming my attachment to the state of Israel. But there are people who feel otherwise. And we see it in American politics regarding what we may or may not say about this country. We see it in politics around the world. So I think that this is just one example of a much bigger problem of understanding that you can love something deeply and still be deeply critical at the same time.
I want to thank Derek Penslar for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about you and about your books?
Well, the easiest way to find out about my books is just on Amazon or any other online retailer. They're all there. And then to find out more about me, just Google Derek Penslar, Harvard University, and I have several web pages at the university, and welcome to browse them. And there's links to videos and talks I've given, and you can find more about me there than you might ever want to know.
Thank you so much, and l'shana tova, a good new year to come.
Shana tova u'mitzvah.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation, known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be actress Swell Ariel Orr and director Karen Nechmad of the award-winning new Israeli film on Netflix, Kisufim. It's a great film. Don't miss the interview. Join us, Congregation Beit Simcha, every Friday night. Services in Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning, 2, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading, Kiddush in person and on our Facebook page. And sign up for This Is Judaism, a wonderful free class on everything you want to know about Judaism. Plus, make arrangements now for the Jewish High Holy Days coming to our synagogue in just 2.5 weeks. Call Beit Simcha, 520-276-5675, or go to Beitsimcha Tucson, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join us for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur this year. To play us out this morning for the coming days of awe, here's Berosh Hashanah. On Rosh Hashanah it's written, on Yom Kippur it is sealed. Who shall live, who shall die? My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of justice and peace.
Berosh Hashanah Ikatevon Uvyom Tzom Kippur Yechatemon Berosh Hashanah.
sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.